Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of Heart Home Faith. I'm your host, Olivia, and I'm so excited to be bringing you today's content. This is a continuation of where we left off last week with Letitia Ochoa Adams's interview about poverty in America, especially what it looks like today. This particular part of the episode is going to tackle different topics related to poverty. Letitia is going to share her experiences with racism and how there is racial inequity that is part of poverty in America. This is such an important episode, and we need to take the time to really digest it. Thank you so much for tuning in to part two of Poverty in America with Letitia Ochoa Adams. You know, the many, many issues and incidents of racial injustice in America this past year, you've been really quite vocal. I understand that you have a lot of ties to specifically the Black community. So this question is, again, not meant to be a deep dive, but just to help people who care, because I care, and I'm assuming a lot of people like me care, but we just don't have the experience, the knowledge, the immersion. And so, you know, as we want to learn, it can be sometimes hard to cross out of that discomfort and to say, I have to really challenge myself to think about this. But, you know, I kind of want to talk about race and poverty for just a minute. And I'm curious, you know, what is your perspective on how race is impacting poverty?
They go hand in hand. And it is intentional for so many reasons. I think that anyone who truly wants to, you know, look into this further and begin figuring out their place and standing in solidarity with the Black community has to read a book called So You Want to Talk About Race, and then go on to read a book by, I think he's a priest, Brian Massengill. Have you heard of him?
I
can send you the links to the to both of those books, so you can add them if you want to your show notes. But those two books are very eye-opening. One is just, it's a secular book on racism written by a Black woman. And then the other one is written specifically for a Catholic perspective. And I think it's important for us, this is the thing when it comes to Catholicism and racism. We as Catholics have the blueprint on how to reconcile with God and with one another. We have an examination of what are our sins, what are our faults, what have we done, what have we failed to do, right? And yeah. Then we have confession. So we confess those things, and then we have penance, and then we have reconciliation. We understand this blueprint and every other aspect of our life. And I think that we can lead in that blueprint when it comes to racism. I also, the reason why is because it's so easy to look at, quote unquote, the bad sides of town in any area and to decide that it's because they don't know how to act right, when we fail to see the lack of resources that are, so openly. I live in the suburbs now, and it is a completely different life than when I lived on the quote unquote bad side of town. A completely different life. Like I can access anything I need in this magical land called the suburbs of Austin. It's great, but the goal shouldn't be to get everyone to be able to live in the suburbs. The goal should be to have, you know, every child deserves to have a gallon of milk in the refrigerator. Like my oldest son, when we moved to the suburbs, had a best friend who had like 3 gallons of milk in his refrigerator. And Anthony could not even imagine the level of wealth you had to be able to drink milk whenever you wanted to. Because in our house, it was like you got one glass of milk a day and that was it. Cause it was just so expensive. And also, historically, racism has everything to do with poverty. We have poverty in America specifically. Like, you can talk about the history of human race and it's probably a different answer, but when it comes to America specifically, we have the poor because of white supremacy. And that isn't just that the poor are only Black and brown and indigenous, but the poor are also white. And if you look at the history, those people weren't considered white when they got here. Like, Irish people were not considered in the group of white when they first got here. Neither were Germans. And so this idea of what is white and why it was created, everyone has to do their own homework to figure that out, because we all have to detach from that on our own. No one can do it for us. It's like becoming Catholic. Like, you can tell people all day long, dude, you should become Catholic. It's literally the best. They're gonna be like incense, rosaries, mass, holy days of obligation. Like, they're looking at all this stuff, but until they have that encounter for themselves with it and grapple with it and learn about it on their own, it's not going to be real to them. And I think that the same thing goes for race and how it impacts poverty. And the bottom line for me is this: when people have resources, we can cut out so many things that cause us as an entire country to be less than our potential. Addictions, crime, diseases of despair, suicide rates. I mean, there's just so many things. As a whole, we benefit when everyone has access to resources that are required for human flourishing. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that in the United States of America, we have to grapple with our history of racism.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And it's an uncomfortable thing. And yes, it's just like, you know, it's one of those things that it's so hard to say I'm wrong, or a belief system that I was raised in was wrong, or, you know, I went to a Catholic school, but why were there no people of color in the school? You know, those are hard questions, and they're uncomfortable. And it's just, I think it really goes to show that, you know, the whole idea of systemic racism, the whole idea of purposefully funneling resources into other areas, so that, you know, the perceived, you know, better side of town could flourish as opposed to the other. I live right outside of Detroit. And so there's parts of Detroit that have experienced gentrification, whatever your opinions are on gentrification, that's for another time. But, you know, I drive through part of Detroit on my way to get to my parents' house. And like, when I lived in Texas, I tell people, oh, we're from the Detroit area. And they'd be like, what? Like, you? Like, well, it's not all like what you think. Detroit is actually a really cool city. But there are parts of it that you don't want to be in late at night. And anyways, as I'm driving through to my parents' house, I see some of the houses and I think to myself, like, these houses were someone's pride and joy 50 years ago, or maybe even, well, oh my gosh, now it's 2020, but, you know, 70 years ago in the 1950s, these houses must have looked so different. And it must have been because of the resources that people had, the jobs, the things that were available in the area that allowed them, you know, affordable wage. And it just,
absolutely,
it's easy to be quick to say they don't understand what they need to do, and to like totally pass any sort of responsibility away, other than it is to say, like, hey, something happened. What was it?
And I think the number one thing that I want to get across to people who don't necessarily, so when you were talking about how I have a connection to the Black community, it was because when I was in high school, I moved to a certain side of town, and I was just a child. I was 15 years old, and the Black community is the community that took me in. They took me in, they adopted me. They, you know, my best friend, I went to church with his grandmother. She taught me about Martin Luther King. I was the kid that was like, what's the big deal with, you know, Tupac and Biggie Smalls? And everyone explained it to me. And I got this like history lesson in hip hop and rap. And so they became my family. Now it's easy for me to have conversations with Black people. It's not, and I think that that is one of the things I think for, but I also came from rural Texas. So I understand, like, I came from rural Texas, which is all white, and I wasn't allowed to speak Spanish as a child. So I have all these different experiences. So for me, my suggestion is always to people who want to understand, what the impact of racism is on the Black community. First and foremost, you can't see them as the Black community. They are individual human beings who you will disagree with on some things and you will agree with on other things. But I think the important thing and the important lesson of 2020 is to listen to them, whether you agree or you disagree, to listen to the stories, to listen to their experiences, and to not be fearful, because in this country, we are conditioned to be fearful of Black people and Black people being angry. We are conditioned. You can see it right now. You can see it all the time where, protests are called riots when there's not any rioting, even if there's not any rioting, right? 90% of the protests over the summer were peaceful, and yet they are called riots. And then there, if you have a white college and the kids all jump on the field and start tearing down the goalposts, they're called like, oh, they're, you know, celebrating. It's like, okay. There's just a difference. And once you start realizing those differences in the way things are described, you start to understand that that wears on certain people. It wears on Black people to constantly be put in a frame of a narrative that makes them out to always be the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And so the fear has to be pushed down, because that fear is not real. It's conditioned. It's a condition of living in this country, mm-hmm. And being raised in this country. It's in our DNA as a country, and we can do something about it. And I feel so strongly that we're on some huge change of some huge change, and we all have to be brave enough to go into it with Christ, because he's with us. And trust me, he wants the change. He is not down with racism, even the polite racism, even the we don't know what our own biases are. But that's all part of the Catholic life, right? Examining all of those things and handing them to him and allowing him to change us into who we were created to be.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I guess, so I very clearly state at several points throughout my podcast that I have no political agenda other than to be Catholic, which of course people get really worked up with, because they seem to think that that means the opposite of what they believe. Because of course, as we've seen this year, political ideology is apparently, sometimes a real threat to your religious ideology. And so I think with this election, especially in Michigan, in Detroit, so I'm in the suburbs of Detroit, I'm in a different county, but we saw the comments about Wayne County, which is of course where Detroit is, and Detroit is of course a predominantly Black or very, in parts of it, a poor, impoverished city. And it didn't always used to be like that. And, you know, there's parts of it that aren't, but there's parts of it that are. And so we see it's such a mess over in Detroit, or it's such a mess with the election over in Wayne County. And it's just like, is it? Or is it just, is it
that they're not doing what you want them to do? Or
exactly. Yeah. I think that's definitely worth really examining. And it's really something. I ran the Detroit Marathon last year. So I ran 26.2 miles throughout Detroit.
Wow.
And I'm crazy, but it's okay. But now I can't run a mile because I'm pregnant. I'm like, I'm too tired. But anyways, there's parts of it, there's pockets of it that are just like, these historic homes that are so, so beautiful. But then there's also like the parts of it where, you know, there's gangs or there's, you know, human trafficking. A lot of it has to do with drugs. And there, yeah. it's so sad that, you know, and then I live 25 minutes outside of the city, 25 minutes away from some of these, you know, pockets of areas where that is. And it's just so sad that like, it's so different from, you know, yeah. one to another. It's just, it's crazy to me that
it is crazy. And this is the thing that I tell people too all the time is that, yeah, I mean, the lack of resources or the lack of access to resources, that's really what it is. Because the resources are there. It's just who is able to access them and who is blocked from accessing them. That's the issue. But also there's so much beauty in those sides of town. Like what I learned in growing up, or going to high school in a low income, predominantly black side of town in Amarillo, Texas, is I learned loyalty. I learned community. I learned what it means to keep your mouth shut about things that are none of your business. So, I mean, when I became Catholic and they were like, gossiping is a sin, no problem for me because gossiping will get you you know, punched in the face where I come from. Like, that's just like how it goes. And so like a lot, and it's weird, but when I go back home, I tell a lot of my friends, like there is a parallel to the street code and Catholicism. Like, you know, if I examine my conscience using any examination of conscience that people, you know, print up or write up or whatever, I can see like, okay, no gossiping on the streets. It's called something else, but it's the same thing. It's like, I don't know. There's just lots of parallels to me. I can't think of right now. My brain just turned off, but I learned a lot of really valuable lessons. And I don't think people understand the creativity that comes and the creativity and the intelligence that it takes to live in those areas. And yeah, it's illegal activity, but if they had access to resources, those, you know, same people could be, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's or Elon Musk's or, you know, any number of people that we get to see as Steve Jobs, as quote unquote successful, and maybe even more so because they would have a heart for justice. I've been friends with and know a lot of drug dealers that most people would dismiss as, I don't know, just dismiss entirely. And they're some of the most loyal, caring people who give the most at Christmas time to children in their neighborhood who are considered the Santas of their block because they take the time every year to care for the children in their neighborhood. Are they also doing things that harm their community? Absolutely. But, you know, that is the conflict, honestly, that
right.
happens when you lack resources. And so I always want to, I don't know. I always want to encourage people to see a different side of poverty in general, people that live in poverty. Like they're not, you know, I miss it sometimes. Like I tell my husband, like, it's so quiet here. Like, I just want to go back. And he's like, you're crazy. But I mean, I ended up putting myself in college courses at one time in, you know, the quote unquote bad side of town, just so that I could go back and just be around my same sheep, you know, that we all have the same understanding in life. And it's nice to be around that community. And I get it from when I go back home to my rural hometown in South Texas, where it's like that sense of community. And these two groups of people are, the narrative is that they are anti one another, but I have seen it that they are the same. The values are the same. We care for our own. We look out for our own. We, you know, do whatever we have to take care of our own. And we're family.
Right. Yeah. That sense of family and community, I think is, you know, maybe it's more important when, and so it becomes more visible when you are experiencing these sorts of struggles of, you know, poverty and lack of resources and making these decisions that are difficult. And I think, you know, this isn't to say that either one of us endorses illegal activity, right? Like, no, that's not the point of this. This is to say, like, we have got to stop thinking like, let's judge, and let's start thinking about the whys.
Yes, and then absolutely.
Once we kind of come to the conclusion of like, well, this is why this is an issue, then I have a heart of a teacher because that's my specific, I was trained in teaching. But I think I always want to understand why, because if there's a problem, like you can throw a Band-Aid on it, but that's not going to fix it until you understand why there's an issue, right? Like you're not going to go into surgery and be like, I think it's this, so let's just remove your arm. Like that's, you know, the doctor's got to understand why is there a pain in your arm, you know, like it's that sort of a thing. But okay, I want to ask you one more question, Leticia. Oh no, two more questions. Sorry. But you've talked a little bit throughout this interview about your son Anthony's suicide, and you've been a really big advocate for mental health awareness. It's something that I really admire. I think this year has shown how fragile mental health is, and how it doesn't matter necessarily how many resources you have. Of course, your resources when you realize you're in a mental health crisis look very different, but mental health impacts every single person at some level. And so, you know, I want you to know that I pray for you because I'm a mom too, and I can only imagine what losing one of your children is like, and how terribly empty that must feel in your heart, you know, all the time. And so I do just want to let you know that, like, I feel for you, while knowing that I haven't experienced your loss, but I grieve with you. But I would love to know what your thoughts are on how poverty impacts mental health. And I think you alluded to it a little bit earlier, but could you just shed some more light on, you know, how does poverty impact mental health in a general sort of way?
I think that biologically speaking, being living in poverty creates a consistent fight or flight reaction that never gets turned off. And when you have a heightened sense of danger consistently and constantly, it ends up messing with your hormones. You have high cortisol levels, so it messes with your weight. It messes with your it messes with you physically, just in all kinds of ways. Sleep, not being able to sleep, not being able to relax, not being able to enjoy things. I mean, so not only was that for Anthony's own, you know, childhood in poverty, but it was also my childhood in poverty, because we're also learning about epigenetics, which is, so as a child, I already had the eggs that were going to turn into my kids, you know? And then not just that, but when I got pregnant with Anthony, I was in a heightened state of crisis, poverty, that I got from my mother, because I was in her womb and marinated in that same stuff, and she was marinated in the same stuff. And I mean, like, you just, so you end up with this, like, you know, quadrupled effect when you get to Anthony. If you just go back to my grandmother, my mother and I, this quadruple effect of Anthony having been created in a state of fight or flight, you know, in a state of crisis. And so one, that has everything to do with, you know, him, his DNA, his genetic makeup. And then also his childhood was traumatic, because I was a poor mother and constantly trying to figure out what we were going to do and how we were going to survive. And then when he was 3 years old, I married my first husband, who had a struggle with addiction from his own trauma. He witnessed his best friend die when he was 17 years old in a car accident. So all of that stuff, Anthony really was in Anthony's environment. Before Anthony was born, while I was pregnant with Anthony, through Anthony's childhood, his entire environment was it was in this crisis and poverty, you know. So, I mean, his entire life, his goal was to get out of it, was to have a better life, to be successful, to have money, to buy his favorite car. When he was 18 years old, he bought his first Mustang cash with money he had worked for and he had saved up for. And that's the kind of person he was. He was very responsible. He carried a lot on his shoulders. He carried it elegantly and well. So the problem was, when he had his mental break, was a combination of traumas that triggered him. And then my uncle passed away, who was like a dad to us. And so he had a mental break. And because of the fact that he had always subscribed to the idea that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, he didn't know what to do. He refused help for a long time and thought he could just help himself. Like, I'll just take care of myself. I'll just meditate. Throw myself into my music. He was really into music and it just didn't work for him. So he felt as if he was failing, even though this was a biological response to something that he didn't really have control over. And I think that that is the bottom line for me. It's like, for Anthony specifically, he did lack access to resources. I lacked access to resources. I should have had mental health care from a small child, because I was sexually abused as a small child. I grew up without a father. I was bullied a lot in school. And so if I had had trauma-informed care as a child, I might not have made the same choices that ended up with my son living in childhood trauma. Or I could have gone to therapy as a mother. And as I have done in the last 10 years, and it would have helped my children too. You know what I mean? But there was not, when you go get your food stamps, no one's saying, and how are you mentally? And what are you doing to take care of yourself? Everyone is saying, get more money, more job, you know, get another job, make more money. Who cares your mental health? Who cares about, you know, self-care or whatever? You're poor. You don't have the luxury of caring for yourself. And so that's the messages you get. Right? So all of those things contributed to Anthony's, first of all, mental break, the lack of him seeking help. And when we did finally get to a place where he was willing to get help, it was a struggle to get, you know, financially. Sure, if we had had a lot of money, we could have found a place. But I mean, it's expensive. It's just expensive. And so then when he died by suicide, I made it my mission to make sure all of us went to therapy. That was expensive. If I hadn't had donations, we wouldn't have been able to do it. I mean, it was the first 6 months after Anthony's suicide, there was seven of us going to weekly therapy sessions. There were $60 a pop, which is cheap. We got a break because, you know, we got really lucky that we had good therapists. But that's still seven people once a week, $60 each.
Right. Yeah.
You're that's looking a lot at of
$700-ish dollars, right? I mean, a little less, but $650, whatever. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot of money.
My one of my daughters has some own particular behavioral issues, and so she sees a psychiatrist as we've been trying to work through that. And I was amazed because I have had excellent health insurance for the past couple of years, and it's been incredible. But the psychiatrist does not take health insurance. It is out of pocket. So I'm like, you know, I actually remember, you know, coming home and just sitting there, sitting at my office and just crying, thinking like, what do people do who can't afford this for their kids? Because I love my children. I want them to have everything they need. And like, it's not her fault that, you know, chemically there's an imbalance with hormones.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. Like, it's, you know, just like it's not your fault if you have diabetes and you, your body doesn't produce enough insulin, right? Like, it's not. Sometimes yeah. this sort of stuff just happens. And so, like, I'm thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, I spend how much money going to my child's psychiatrist?
Yeah.
But, like, I do it because I love her, but it is expensive. And yes, and, like, yeah. that's not even with, you know, therapy, which of course you start with. And so it's
absolutely. And people without those resources just don't do it. Mm-hmm. And that is why you see the things that you see. Again, when you're looking at, you know, the quote unquote poor side of town or the bad side of town, and you're like, what is their problem? That is all trauma. It's all trauma. That's and it's untreated trauma. And people think it's moral failure, or it's they don't know how to behave, or it's this or it's that. It's racism and trauma. And racism is traumatic, you know, to the Black community and to the Indigenous community. And on some levels, to the Latinx community. All different kinds of trauma, but all traumatic. And it's on all unresolved trauma and hundreds of years of unresolved trauma. I mean, when people are like, what is happening in our country? It's so crazy. Isn't 2020 crazy? And I'm just like, yeah, it's all unresolved trauma. Like, anyone who lives in a family with unresolved trauma knows it's chaos, totally dysfunctional, complete chaos. You never know what's going to happen. There's always a crazy uncle that is saying crazy stuff constantly. I mean, that's what 2020 is. It's just accumulation of our unresolved traumas,
right? You know? And being thrust into a situation that we don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with.
Yes.
And I think absolutely. that's really important too when we think about mental health, is we think about, like, well, like you were saying, I mean, if you'd had trauma inclusive care, trauma-based care, you would have learned coping mechanisms that might have led to different yeah. choices or, you know, different things. But, like, what do you do if you have no coping mechanisms?
Yeah. And the same for Anthony. Like, the thing is that, just think about, to me, I imagine a world where, so Anthony, my second oldest, Daniel, and I all worked at the same place. I waited tables. My son Daniel was a busser. Anthony was a dishwasher. And I imagine a reality where I could have gone to work and said, Anthony is having a mental health crisis and he needs a week off work, and then pay him for that week and then pay for his health care coverage to go to therapy or seek whatever kind of help he needed, go to a hospital that cares about his trauma and cares about him instead of making money, right? And how different that would have been than going into work and saying, or calling into work and saying, I can't come to work tomorrow, and neither is Anthony and neither is Dan, because Anthony's died by suicide. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been a whole different way. And that's what I mean by, like, a trauma-informed culture, which is what I am the most passionate about, because I just think that we don't have any coping mechanisms. Yeah. And the ones we have are not real. I think that Anthony's coping mechanism for most of his life was, I can do this. I just need to think positive. I just need to get up off the couch. I just need to work harder. I just need to make money. That coping mechanism of, if I just had more money, everything would be fine, is the prosperity gospel that is deadly.
Exactly.
And I almost feel as if you can trace almost so many suicides to that, regardless of how much money that person has, because the idea is, if I had enough money, I'd be fine. And then you can either never feel like you're going to get that much, or you're never, or you have so much money and you're still not okay. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So all the way around, I consistently and constantly just push for trauma-informed culture, where you right. can't come into work and say, I'm having a bad mental health day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that's obviously frowned upon.
Yes, it
in
is.
Every and aspect.
And it's frowned upon for kids at school. I've created that with my family, and I advocate strongly to other parents, like, especially right now in this pandemic, your kid is in elementary school, or junior high where there's no finals and they're struggling right now on, what is this? If they're struggling right now, December 10th is when we're recording this, right? 2020. And they are, or let's say, you know, or the spring at the end of the school year, they're not, they don't have finals. They're in elementary school. They're in junior high and they're struggling mentally with school. Email the teachers and tell them my kids are checking out. Like we're, I don't know what we need to do. Do we need to do reading time? What is it that I need to do to help my child and stand in that gap between your child and the school? Because they don't need, I have seen so many people say they have to push through. They have to push through. No, do not make your children push through. Stand up, fight for them, for their mental health. Cause then you teach them to advocate for their own mental health. And that is how we're going to get a culture that understands mental health days. When there's moms standing in the office going, no, no, you're not putting that pressure on my child. They are having a bad mental health day.
Mm-hmm. And everybody has them.
Yes.
I think that's the thing that people, you know, you can seem as happy as you please to the outside world, but the reality is every single person has days where you have a bad mental health day. Yeah. And if it, we lived in a world where it was acceptable to say your feelings can exist,
yeah,
and you are not the sum of your feelings, and you just, you have feelings, think about them, think about where they're coming from, know that you are not right or wrong to have these feelings, they're just your feelings, and it's okay, and that you can take a break from the stress of life. But of course, when you're in poverty, you don't have that. You don't have the ability to take a break, which is just something that I think people don't really realize is an option.
Exactly. And it, And I think if there is going to be some kind of space made for, I mean, obviously the first step has to be racial reconciliation and dealing with our history and then access to resources. And then for one of those resources to be trauma-informed everything. I don't think it just needs to be schools. I think it needs to be hospitals. I think it needs to be doctors. So many times, you know, my granddaughter Aaliyah was only 3 years old when Anthony died by suicide. And that's his oldest child. And she would break out with these weird rashes. And the doctor would be like, oh, it's just a virus. Like without taking into consideration that this child just lost her father, who was a hands-on father in her life. And so didn't even consider the trauma-based fact of why this child was breaking out in hives every 5 seconds. You know what I mean? And so there's just so many areas where people don't even take trauma into consideration. And yet it's scientific fact that trauma impacts our health, impacts our physical health, impacts our ability to think, our ability to focus. I had a fight with my college, my Catholic seminary, to explain to them that I was traumatized after my son's suicide and I needed a break in my, you know, studies. And that just shouldn't be. That just shouldn't happen. And so I think there are steps. And like I said, the first one to me is racial reconciliation. And then, access to resources, and then for one of those resources to be trauma-informed care in every aspect of our lives.
Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, I just stepped back from my job at my parish, which I loved, and our parishes can do such amazing work, but I feel like it can be really difficult sometimes to say, hey, like, what are our parishes doing for this? But like, that is a real need for parishes to at least have the name of people that, you know, you can give when someone comes to you and says, I am going through some, like, because when you work at a parish, people just tell you things about their life. Like, it's just like, okay, I am not a trained mental health professional. And, you know, but it's, you know, I feel like maybe, just maybe, we need to be sharing this information with our parishes. Like, you know, we need to be able to say, like, who is a good Catholic therapist in the area? Who is a good person? Who's trained in this?
Yes.
To provide resources, to be that, you know, not to be that bootstrap, to be that, you know, we're going to help you. We can't physically be the person who does this because we aren't trained. And it takes obviously highly specialized people in this training to offer the sort of, you know, assistance that you might need for these particular traumas, but like, who are the people that can do that? Where are they?
Yeah.
So anyways, that's just kind of a thought that I'm thinking of. No,
I think that that is so important because the parish should be the heart of the community. Mm-hmm. Everyone should know. And I mean, my parish has a St. Vincent de Paul. Everyone in my community knows if you're struggling, you can go to St. Vincent de Paul and see if they can help you. So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And that is supposed to be what, yes, the parish is supposed to offer the sacraments. Obviously, no, I'm not downplaying any of that. You know, mass and the sacraments are the priority of a parish, but at the end of mass, there's a reason why we say, go out and, you know, live your life, you know, honoring God. It's like, because that's the whole freaking point. Like, we're not supposed to just navel gaze all day long and high five one another for being Catholic. We're not, that's not what it's all about. It's about going out into our communities and living a witness of Christ.
Right. Absolutely. So this is a great segue for my last question for you, but, so I've heard your conversion story a little bit, and I know that's like a whole another episode, but knowing that you converted to Catholicism and that, you know, all those years ago when I heard your story and I thought to myself, oh my gosh, she has an incredible story. And knowing that all these other chapters have since unfolded and just knowing that like life happens, you know, it's been 7 years since I first heard you speak. And, wow. I know, is that crazy? I was such a baby. I was 23 years old. so young. But you know, what is your favorite thing about Catholicism?
I think that my favorite thing about Catholicism is the depth of our knowledge. Like, in Catholicism, there's just so many roads that can lead you to know God deeper and better. You can do devotions, you can pray the rosary, you can do liturgy of the hours, philosophy, sociology. I mean, John Paul II, you know, everyone thinks theology of the body is just about sex. And it's like, it's so much more. It's about the human person and how we're created and what our tendencies are and why are they that way? And how can we like rise above them? Also, in Catholicism, I have yet to find a question that I ask that some saint has not already asked or that is impossible to ask. Like there are some Catholics who are scandalized and shocked by certain questions, but Catholicism itself as an entire, as an entirety can handle any question. And you can look for, are there aliens? You can literally go philosophically to Thomas Aquinas and start like checking out what did he say about this or what did he say about that? And you can just go down a rabbit hole looking for an answer to the most ridiculous questions, and you might end up with like your this is a ridiculous question might be at the end of that rabbit hole, but you realize how much, like I said earlier, like how practical God is. Like God is not a magic fairy in the sky. God is very intentional. Everything is very ordered. Everything has a specific purpose and a potential, and that is what it means when we say God loves us, that's what we mean. It's intentional. You're purposeful. You are an intentional choice. And so that's what I love the most about Catholicism. And it's why I'm still Catholic, even though there's so much crazy.
I hear you. I hear you. You know, the thing that astonishes me, and you mentioned you're taking grad school level classes. I just finished up one of my grad school level classes. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to continue now that I've stepped back from my job, but I love learning. And so like, one of the best things for me is that I'll just continue studying on my own. Cause I'm, as I said before, I'm weird. I run marathons and I study. I'm strange. It's okay. But I love it. Like I love to dive into it because the further you go, the more logical sense it makes. And logic is the thing that is totally missing from our society. Like, and I think I'm going to just blame social media for a quick second because like you can just post something and you don't have to actually think about the logical implications of like, well, wait, does this phrase actually work with this phrase? Does this actually mean what I think it means? But like in Catholicism, like the entire doctrine of the church has been thought through logically to like, you know, look for error, and it's stood the test of time. So I absolutely love the depth of it. Like you're saying, like there's so much, you can peel it back a little bit at a time. And if you take the time to do that, you realize this is really, really smart. But if you don't,
and I think, and that's the thing. I think, and so once I get done being angry at whatever dumb thing gets typed on a blog or something by a Catholic, like after the anger is sadness. Cause it's like, there's so much beauty here. There's so that we're and when I, one of my top pet peeves is when people say, I'm not smart enough to read an encyclical. And it's like, no, you are, because knowledge is a gift from God for us to know him. That's literally the only reason why you have intelligence. You don't have intelligence to watch Netflix, which is fun. Don't get me wrong. I also binge watch Netflix, or to read the greatest, you know, to read the Twilight series novels or whatever. Like that's not what our intelligence is for. Those are all entertaining, and there's nothing wrong with being entertained. We're also made for stories. Jesus told stories all the time for a reason, but also our intellect is a specific purpose, which is to know God. And when you, to me, it makes me so sad when I see such shallow interpretations of the faith, because again, that's Protestants have already done that. Like we're just remaking Protestantism with, and like praying rosaries. Like we're Protestants that pray rosaries. I think it's just sad. Like there's such a missing beauty to understanding the teachings of the church. And it's also why I hate secular reporting on teachings of the church. It's why I hate all of it. Cause there's just such a lack of, the lack of truth is also a lack of beauty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well, Letitia, I just have to say thank you so, so much. Again, I know I'm like this really strange person who runs marathons and studies the Catholic Church for fun, and one time saw you talk 7 years ago, but like, I don't know, I've kept up with you through social media and through things, and I've so appreciated your insight, and I know it's really weird, but I feel like I know you.
I totally get it. I feel the same way. I feel the same way about people all the time, so I totally get it. I totally understand.
But I wanted to say thank you so much. I so appreciate your time, your insight, and I'm so excited to share this. I think I'm going to break it up into two parts, just because it is a longer interview. So I think I'll release those in the new year. But again, just thank you so much. Please know I'm praying for you, and I just so appreciate your vulnerability and your willingness to share your experiences and to just shed light on things that are really uncomfortable for a lot of people to talk about. We need more voices like yours. So please keep it up. Keep going. I love your podcast and the tension. So please, 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 please keep that going too.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. All right. You have a blessed day.
You too. Bye. Bye.
So much for tuning in to today's episode and for taking the time to listen to Letitia's heart, her wisdom, her vulnerability, all of the things she has experienced, the way that she shares them with a heart for awareness, the way that she shares them with a heart to help people understand that it's not what we think. I am so grateful that you've tuned in. I'm so grateful that you've heard her words. And I hope and I pray that you are moved to do something. To know that we can find a cause, we can find a way that we can also help raise awareness, that we can work to eliminate these social injustices in our society. Please follow Letitia, support her on her Patreon, help her to create the work that she is creating to bring about awareness, to help those of us who have not experienced these issues to understand them on a deeper, authentically Catholic level. Thank you again to Letitia. And thank you for all of you who took the time to listen. and to take Letitia's words to heart. Until next time, may you feel as loved as you are.